Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The killer dentist, as he's been called, James Craig is his name, and it's all alleged. He's innocent until proven guilty, but the allegations are stark. Could be one of the most bizarre, methodically prosecuted murder trials in recent Colorado history. And joining us to help us break it down is someone who's been in the courtroom many of the days, defense attorney, former prosecutor Eric Faddis, right there, seeing every shocking twist from the protein shake poisonings to Google search breadcrumbs today. Going to walk us through how the state built the case that's as disturbing as it is surgically constructed. The big question is, what flavor were the smoothies? Do we know the flavor? Do we have a flavor? Is it just banana protein powder and ice and cyanide, or what do we know about that part of this?
Yeah, I think the most of which I'm aware is that they had a weird chemical taste to them.
Yeah,
and that was likely the cyanide and or arsenic. There were multiple smoothies that were allegedly poisoned, but didn't hear whether they were strawberry banana or something else.
I wonder if he Googled that. Did he like look up like what pairs well with arsenic? You know, maybe a little some goji berries or something. It really masks the arsenic flavor. Anyway.
Kind of acai blend.
Acai blend, yes. You got to get the acai in there. Acai to me already tastes like very metallic in some ways and very poisonous almost. I've yet to find I want to like acai. I have yet to like acai. There's just kind of a thing about it. Love, hate, I guess. Anyway, beyond that, you've sat through every moment of this, a lot of moments of the trial anyway. What to you so far has been one of the more damning moments or the most damning moment from the prosecution, and why do you think it's hit so hard?
Well, yesterday, there was a bombshell dropped while I was in the courtroom. They had an inmate on the stand. He was an inmate in the same facility as James Craig. And James Craig allegedly asked him to do a number of things. One is kill the lead detective. Two is essentially recruit folks who would say they were friends of Angela Craig and that she was suicidal at the time. And in fact, there was a letter that was introduced into evidence purportedly written by James Craig that details all of these incriminating aspects of the case. And James Craig, after it was read, was pretty reserved and seemed rather disheartened.
Oh, his ego, his kind of verboseness went down a little bit, are you saying? Interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's been rather animated in the courtroom involved and kind of has a confident demeanor. Mm-hmm. But they read that letter in painstaking detail to the jury. And after that, he was kind of slouching in his chair and not so animated.
All right. Obviously, there's no cameras in the courtroom. There's no audio in the courtroom. Give me your best description of what that letter said.
Yeah, so it was written very eloquently. There were words like suppositional and ill-fated and things like that. secrets you might commonly associate with, you know, the average inmate letter that comes out of a jail. So they're saying that connects it to James Craig in detailed roles that he wanted folks to play. There were at least four roles, and those included people who would say they were friends of Angela Craig. And there were details like, hey, you went to Angela Craig's meeting. She had like hobbies and meetings that she would go to. You met her there and you realized she was suicidal and that kind of thing. There were also requests to fabricate different evidence, to tamper with evidence, and ultimately to kill the lead investigator, Bobby Olson.
This is like such an extreme. I mean, this takes this case, as quite often happens, the worst, not the worst things, but the incrimination gets even more incriminating after the fact. Had he not done all of these things, he might have a much, you know, stronger case or less things to go on that make him look so damn guilty. And now that there's the letter, that takes it from just hearsay. It takes it from just some inmate saying, I'll tell you whatever you want to hear. So he gets some sort of leniency or kickback to a new level of incrimination. Almost makes me wonder, did he have ChatGPT write it? The way that it was that eloquent, did that run through your mind at all? Like, because it is written so well, was it handwritten, I'm going to guess?
Was handwritten.
Okay.
The handwriting seemed consistent with other writings James Craig had done. However, my understanding is the prosecution didn't have a handwriting expert look at it. And so I think the defense is going to try to challenge it on that angle, but it's going to be tough.
Why not have? Okay. This is another one of those where it's like, okay, you got it. The one thing you could do to screw this up or give reasonable doubt over here is not have a handwriting expert look at it. Why not?
It doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, these prosecutors, I know them very well, Ryan Brackley and Mike Morrow, they are usually meticulous and methodical, and they have been throughout the trial. This seemed to be an oversight of sorts. It would have been relatively easy to enlist a handwriting expert. The state does it all the time. They have the resources to do it. And so this was kind of a loose end that has not been tied up yet.
I mean, does budgetary restraints come into that? Does discovery timelines play into that at all? Obviously these things happened after the crime. They just kind of added to the criminality of the whole damn thing. Is that a factor in something like that? Or is it just kind of like, look, jury, here's his handwriting, here's that handwriting. Do you really need this person over here to tell you that this is his handwriting?
Yeah, Toby, I'm actually, I was formerly a prosecutor in the same office that's mm-hmm. prosecuting James Craig now. And for homicide cases, especially high profile ones, they really spared no expense. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was a resource issue. You know, they have so many aspects of this case that are compelling, that are incriminating. And I think they probably just determined, hey, I think we've got enough here. Let's move forward and we'll deal with whatever challenge the defense brings.
There's been a lot of Google searches in this as well, how to make murder look like a heart attack, undetectable poisons. Again, he didn't search for what would blend well with arsenic, which might have made a little better. But I'm imagining those Google searches also have not played well in court. How has the jury been reacting to those? And also, how has he been reacting to those as these little revelations get sprinkled throughout the trial?
You know, the jury, especially at these dramatic moments during the Google searches, during the letters, they were on the edge of their seat and they're taking notes. They're looking at the monitors when the letter is published to the jury. They are very engaged. And in fact, after that letter, there was a bench conference and the jurors all kind of like had a like, whoa, that was clearly a big deal in this trial. James Craig throughout, like I said, has been rather confident. And in fact, when some of this evidence comes out, he's shaking his head no. You can see him. Some people say that's sort of trying to telegraph some kind of signal to the jury that, hey, this isn't legitimate or whatever. But like I mentioned, after this letter was read and they went through, I think it's 9 pages or so, they went through the highlights over a course of about 45 minutes. And James Craig was sort of slouching in his seat. He was not animated. He was not engaging with his attorneys. He seemed a bit forlorn at that point.
That's interesting, because if at the beginning he's trying to do this persona of, oh, wrongfully accused, this is, what are they making up over here? You would think that would be consistent throughout, no matter what's being brought up. If it's all a bunch of BS and the state's out to get the dentist for whatever reason, because, you know, states just like to target dentists for some reason. I mean, it's they're anti-dentites. They are. It's going after the dental community. It's one of those things where inconsistent behavior then in that arc where, okay, you're kind of like over here. Now that's really showing something. How do you think the jury is reading the tea leaves on this?
I think the jury is very closely monitoring James Craig's demeanor, how he's presenting in court, how he's reacting to these pieces of evidence, because he's been doing it the whole time and he does it in a noticeable way. So surely the jury observed that. And, you know, even in the letter itself, James Craig says a few weird things. He says that the state is after him, doing evil tactics against him, so he has to resort to the same, or something to that effect. Additionally, he alleges in the letter that the office manager, Romero, actually did the Google searches that were highly incriminating to sort of frame him for some kind of unarticulated reason.
Do you think this man is having a mental health crisis at the end of the day? Because if we're talking like the state's after me for this or that, maybe they are. I mean, but maybe for a real valid reason. But if it sounds more like, you know, paranoid delusions and killing his wife, or he didn't kill his wife. I mean, that's what I'm wondering. Are we dealing with something here beyond just, I'm trying to cover this murder up because I wanted to go have, you know, endless affairs and I didn't want my money to be cut in half? I'm wondering if there is a mental health component to this that we're not seeing, because it does kind of feel like this guy may be a little bit not playing with a full deck, or not playing with reality on reality's terms.
You know, that's the thing. He certainly seems detached from reality in multiple pieces of evidence and throughout multiple stages of the case. He sort of has this overblown delusional confidence, like he can't be touched. He's writing these letters from jail, knowing that jail letters are subject to review by jail authorities. And so it seems like for a while he was just disconnected to the gravity of what was going on, and sort of had this paranoid air about him. You know, probably doesn't rise to the level of any kind of defense, and then it's sort of undercut by how articulate he is in these letters and in some other communications. So I don't think it's going to help him much, but does he have a firm grasp on reality? No.
I mean, yeah, it feels, and obviously I can't diagnose, but it feels like a narcissistic personality disorder or borderline or something along those lines, where that grandioseness is there, but it doesn't, it's not conclusive to reality. It's not there where it makes any sort of sense. I know the daughter read the deepfake letter or the request deepfake letter in court as well. We talked about that a little bit earlier in the week. But let's talk a little bit more about that. How has that been playing to the jury, with the daughters being on the stand? And obviously, he's not only asked another inmate to try and kill for him, to try and set up fake witnesses and write the letter and all that. He's also asked his daughter to be a part of this and create like a deep fake video of mom making a suicide note video, which is not something that anyone can really do that easily.
Totally. And I think I've got to imagine the jury was rather offended by that, because what it means, not only is he allegedly enlisting his own daughter in the cover-up of the murder of her mother, but on top of that, he's exposing his own daughter to possible criminal liability for fabricating false evidence. And that just goes a little more to the kind of the misplaced confidence of this guy to think that his daughter could, you know, who was, I think, 20 or 21, could create some kind of convincing deepfake video, send it to authorities, and somehow absolve him from this horrible murder saga that he appears to have gotten himself into.
And also, for doing the personality trait thing and trying to figure out what the hell's going on here, what's the recipe behind this man? It plays back into the, okay, well, if he's got a personality disorder, again, all these are traits of that way of thinking. And once you kind of figure out, okay, well, here's the recipe, and you know what's in the cake. And he's the cake. Very not delicious one. to say it lightly. I've never compared anyone to a cake.
Yeah, cake has some arsenic.
It's a bad cake. Don't put arsenic in the cake. It's like when you do salt instead of sugar, and it just doesn't work out well. I want to talk about this. You've now heard, you know, so many things about the mistresses, the money problems, every lie. And in any case, obviously, he doesn't need to, you know, show the motive. The state does. We don't need a motive, but it certainly helps at the end of the day. What is the strongest motive that's been laid bare here by the prosecution thus far?
They've centered on sort of dual motives, two factors that they believe caused James Craig to kill his wife. One is the adultery, which apparently had been going on for some time, sounds like years. And there was an event of adultery, I believe in December 2022, so about 3 months before his wife is killed. So that is a big one, including that James Craig was continuing to text and correspond with his mistress while his wife was in the hospital dying. On top of that, he was having serious money issues. He had had a former bankruptcy in 2020 or so, and he had partnered with Dr. Ryan Redfern, another dentist, and things were not going well financially. And so a lot of people thought, hey, this is his way to sort of start anew, do away with those troubles in his life and not have to deal with them in sort of a new life that he wanted to create for himself.
There's undertones of Peterson in this, of Lacey Peterson and Scott Peterson, the affair, I'm going to send you a picture of my wife dying. I mean, it's reminiscent of Scott. I'm watching the stars and the fireworks go off while, you know, he's not searching for his wife. That sort of weird dichotomy of a relationship there. Sugar Baby added another term to the trial this week. Why don't you explain to us what Sugar Baby means and how it applies to this case and what Sugar Baby had to say about Mr. Craig?
Yeah. So, you know, Sugar Baby is essentially someone who involves themselves in a kind of transactional relationship with someone else in order to get benefits, usually monetary benefits, from that person. And it's sort of an agreed upon arrangement where both sides are cool with it. That's rather more common than people think, I believe. In fact, there are apps where you can become a sugar baby and find sugar daddies. And so in our modern culture, that's something that continues to come up. And there is evidence of kind of a transactional sort of relationship between James Craig and his mistress and potentially with other subjects of his infidelity.
We used to just call it prostitution. But now let's call it's sugar. Like, it's the same. I mean, it's monetary. Yeah. I mean, it's like an agreed upon thing. But I guess we found a way of normalizing it in some way, shape, or form and making websites out of it and making it a lifestyle. Let me ask you about this. How important is it that in this timeline that he was actually with the mistresses or the sugar babies or whoever he was with was not his wife while the wife was dying? How much is that? How crucial is that to the jury when they're trying to examine this guy? I mean, take the murder out of it. I mean, just you add this piece into it. I mean, these are damning things that people will, you know, indict on just on character, even if your crime is harder to prove.
I think there are two ways that plays into the case. The first way is that it just shows kind of a callous indifference to the health state of his wife. You know, if he didn't do this, you would imagine the husband would be much more concerned and not, you know, overly focused on some new romantic fling, but instead wanting, his wife and loved one, even if they had a falling out, to live, you know. And then secondly, I think that it undercuts his argument that he wanted to still be with the wife. The defense has sort of pressed this by saying, hey, in the text messages, he's saying he still wants to be married. You know, things are not over. And that doesn't sound like someone who wants to kill their wife. However, when you compare that to the fact that he is so interested and kind of obsessed with this mistress during this specific time frame while his wife is dying, it makes it seem like, no, he probably isn't so into repairing his marriage. And maybe it suggests that he's actually wanting that to happen, meaning his wife died.
I mean, it's trying to make sense out of crazy at the end of the day with somebody like this, because we're looking for sensical solutions, so sensical answers, how we would handle it, how a healthy brain would handle something like this. And we're not dealing with a healthy brain. He probably wanted both. He wanted his wife and he wanted the sugar baby too. And, you know, and every other candy in the machine. He wanted the Mambas. He wanted the Charleston Chew and the sugar baby. And there's the sugar daddy, too, which is a larger piece of caramel, which if you really chew on it, it gets stuck in your teeth and it's not that fun. I'm not a big fan of those. They're delicious, but not a candy I would choose if given the opportunity. That's a public service message. But yeah, it's do you think there's anything left here? Based on what you've seen in court, obviously the prosecution has now rested. The defense is having their turn to go and take a run at this. Is there any path here for them to introduce reasonable doubt? Do you think they can trump what has been brought by the prosecution?
Well, it's tough. The case got even worse for James Craig yesterday, where it's my understanding that someone connected to the wife, it might have been her sister, testified that there was a prior drugging incident during which, allegedly, James Craig wanted to commit suicide. Angela Craig didn't want him to do that, so he drugged her so she could not prevent him from doing this. We have a history of drugging in this drugging homicide case. That being said, I think the defense is going to focus on Angela Craig's mental state at the time. She was going through a rough patch. You know, people go through rough patches. James Craig alleges that there was a prior opioid overdose attempt by Angela Craig. We haven't heard a ton of evidence about that. Might come out in defense's case in chief. They're going to have to angle towards her being suicidal, but who would poison themselves over the course of weeks during mass suffering? It's not a good way to go out.
No, none of it makes a whole lot of sense at the end of the day. This, I mean, we're talking about probably two fairly unhealthy minds here at the end. I mean, I can't imagine either of them. I mean, maybe one of them started out healthy and the other one wasn't. Maybe they both started out unhealthy. I don't know. But after being married to this man for how many years, I can't imagine anyone's in a good place. Just trying to, you know, navigate the eggshells of the invisible floor that they were living in. Just a messed up case.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.